This is a recording from the New Dominion Bookshop brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit us at sevillepodcast.com. On Thursday, February 28, 2008, author Andy Straka discussed his new novel, Record of Wrongs. After an introduction from Nancy Damon, program director for the Virginia Festival of the Book, Straka spoke for several minutes about Record of Wrongs and the real-life events behind the novel.
Thanks, Nancy. Thanks. I started working on Record of Wrongs back in 2002, soon after my first crime novel, A Witness Above, was published. And I became intrigued about that time with the whole idea of DNA exonerations. They had really started to hit the news in increasing numbers about that time. And it was an interesting subject to me. I thought that it had a lot of elements that would make for a good crime novel. So I started, like any good novelist, I started asking myself, what if? You know, what if someone who was released from prison on this kind of sort of basis were approached by the one person in the world, perhaps, who might be even in a better position to demand more justice, and that would be the mother of the young woman that he had been convicted of raping and murdering. And that was sort of the genesis of the idea behind Record of Wrongs, were these two characters and their relationship. And it then evolved into, as most of my books tend to do, a whodunit and a suspense novel with the two of them very haltingly at first, both very flawed characters. Ruth, who is Ruth Crawford, who is the mother of Gwen Crawford, the young woman who was murdered in this book 10 years before. She was a student at a fictional small college in upstate New York. And Quentin Price was a security guard at that college and ended up being convicted for that crime. And now he is out because of the testing, and they meet up. She actually shows up outside the prison and accosts him, and he doesn't know who it is, and there's a lot of elements there. But one thing leads to another. The story ends up being told from four different points of view, from Quentin's point of view predominantly, but then also Ruth's. The other main characters are Jack Crawford, who is Ruth's estranged husband, who is an ex-cop and also a private investigator. I couldn't resist getting a private investigator in there. Since my first series of novels were all PI novels, I had to throw one in there. But and then the fourth main character is a NYPD detective named Garnell Harris, who is called in by the Assistant Attorney General of the state of New York to consult on the case to sort of help out. And is anybody in here familiar with upstate New York? At all? Okay. Little bit. I'm from that area, and Binghamton's a mid-sized city, a little bit smaller than Richmond. It's probably a couple hundred thousand people. And there are not a lot of murders there. You know, it's bigger than Charlottesville, but there may be three or four murders a year. So so the Attorney General's office decides that maybe these local cops aren't quite up to the task and calls in a heavy hitter from the city. The other element that comes into play is that there is a racial component. Quentin Price happens to be African American, and his victim, alleged victim, who he had been convicted of murdering, was white, and the jury that convicted him was predominantly white. So you have all these tensions going on. It's quite a different environment up there than it is down here. I've heard one novelist refer to it as Northern Appalachia. I love it up there. It's a lot different. There's a big difference between New York City and upstate where I'm from. Just a little bit about DNA exonerations, and then I'm going to kind of throw it open to questions and talk a little more about the book. There have been now a total of, I think the latest count was 218 DNA exonerations since 1989. And in the state of Virginia, there is a review currently underway of over 500,000 cases Actually, the preliminary review has already been done. I think they looked at 530,000 old cases. Of those cases, they found over 2,200 that they felt warranted a closer look. And there's different ways to look at that. And DNA exoneration has sort of become a flashpoint now for conflicting views of our criminal justice system. And it's a little bit of a disservice to actually just simply call it DNA exoneration, because it is DNA legal exoneration. The person is legally exonerated. But the fact is, there are some great organizations out there like the Innocence Project, which has pushed this for years, and post-conviction testing and so forth. But even the facts from their own website indicate that the actual perpetrators have been identified in only a little over one-third of those cases. So naturally, as a novelist, I saw that as, that's kind of interesting, because you've now got these situations where a lot of publicity, somebody's getting out of prison, and in some instances, it is theoretically possible that some of these people are actually still guilty of the crime. It's just that their conviction was overturned, and there certainly are a number of prosecutors and policemen who were detectives who feel that may be the case. So that was an opportunity for me to tell a story. I think that there are a number of these DNA exonerations where the way the DNA testing works, the alleged perpetrator, the convictee, or if you will, has totally been excluded, so that there's absolutely no doubt, and that is a complete exoneration. But there are a number, and most of these cases have been very well vetted. So in reality, probably the vast majority of these cases, it is a true exoneration. But there is always that seed of doubt. And when my book was nearing completion and getting ready to go to the publisher about 2 years ago, I happened to read that another local author here in Charlottesville, I think his name's Grisham or something like that, was working on a nonfiction book about a real-life DNA exoneration of a death row inmate from Oklahoma. My first reaction was, wow, that's pretty interesting. I thought, well, you know, while I may never attain Mr. Grisham's, you know, gargantuan sales figures, at least we both share the same sense for what might make a good story. Our books are very different. His is nonfiction. It's a true story, and I recommend it. It's a good book. It's an interesting read. But what I also found interesting, though, is despite the success of that book and the publicity it's gotten, and of course he has a lot to say about the death penalty there, and I don't really go there in my book. It's kind of a non-issue in the state of New York anyway, because they don't really happen anymore in New York. So. But I found that, interestingly enough, there actually is the prosecutor in that case, I forget the name of the town now in Oklahoma, is actually suing. But he has a website, and there are editorials, and that whole town feels that they've been wronged, you know, that the actual person that, you know, was convicted was actually guilty. So there are a lot of strong feelings here on either side, and you know, so to me, it lent more credibility to the characters in my book and to the things that happen and the reactions of the police and the prosecutors. And really, even if a person is truly innocent, they are always going to carry that stigma with them in certain people's minds of having been convicted for that crime. And that's difficult. And it's difficult from a macro, like a public policy perspective, too, and there are a lot of perspectives one way or another on that. There was an article just last week in front page USA Today about an exoneration that occurred in Texas. There have been a number in Texas of late, and I was going to say young man, he's no longer a young man, was in prison for 24 years, if you can believe that. Which to me is just absolutely incredible. He was convicted in 1981 and has spent his whole lifetime behind bars. So obviously, what's interesting to me is that we're fortunate, I think, to live in a system that is self-correcting, that a number of prosecutors now are getting behind this whole innocence, you know, project, you know, looking at the DNA and so forth. But at the same time, there are cross currents there, obviously, because the vast, vast majority of cases, you know, obviously the convictions have been upheld, and if you talk to, you know, criminals in prison, of course, they all say they're innocent, or a huge percentage of them do. So it gets very difficult to sort out the real cases, the genuine cases, from those that aren't. Anyway, so it's a hot button topic. It's something that continues to gain publicity. I think we're going to read more and more about it in the ensuing years. There's a lot of other things going on with DNA testing. We've had the case here of the local rapist and all the controversy surrounding that and the lawsuits and the gathering of DNA. There was another front page article just this past weekend in the Wall Street Journal called The Gene Police about some of the things going on in the UK. And they are way ahead of what, if we think we are invading civil liberties here, you should go to England. It's 4.8, I forget the exact figure, I believe it's 4.8% of the population in England is in the DNA database. And they actually go so far as to do familial sampling so that if they're trying to narrow down a case, they will just get a general DNA marker that somebody that is within the extended family of the actual perpetrator, which might be a pool of, say, 500 people, and then they'll send their detectives out and start interviewing. Now, depending on your perspective on that, you could say, well, that's what a great tool, you know, for detectives to be able to, you know, if you have a rape case or something, to be able to narrow it to, well, it was one of these 500 people. Or you could be really creeped out about that and say, you know, who's got my DNA just because, and they, one of the other things that they do is, they've limited the sample down to 200 cells, which is enough. If you left a cheek print on a window frame, that's enough to give 200 cells. Or if I put my hand on that table for just a few seconds, that's enough that they could gather that off there. So you almost can't breathe on anything, and you're going to be leaving DNA around.
Straka then took questions from the audience. One person asked, do you tend to read books similar to yours while you're writing?
Fictional or non-fiction? If it's non-fiction, fictional, I may check them out just to see what the general plot outline is, but I don't tend to read a lot of fiction when I'm writing. I didn't get a lot of writing done last year because I was a judge for the Eggers and I had to read 500 crime novels. Holy cow. But I try to steer away from that when I'm in the actual midst of writing, but in terms of background research, I do, yes. I like to know what's out there, what's been written, you know, what kind of books are, you know, are out there. There haven't been a lot of nonfiction looks at it, and a lot of articles and so forth, and some documentaries and some looks at, and they all tend to like John Grisham's book. They tend to revolve around an individual case because these stories are compelling, and by and large the stories are going to be. Obviously, you know, if someone's wrongly convicted, that's a huge story, and that's something that needs to be, and that's a great human interest story. And it's sort of the tone that Record of Wrongs begins with, because it's my agent. One of the first things he said to me, he said, this book is all about loss. There's a huge sense of loss for Quentin Price. He's lost these years of his life. For Ruth Crawford, she's lost her only daughter. Her marriage is dissolved. She's drinking. She's got some borderline mental issues and things going on. Her husband is a PI, but he's got a lot of issues himself, and he is obsessed that Quentin is truly guilty, and to the point of potential violence. So there's all these losses. When you have these kind of cases, you know, you have a lot of drama out there, but you also have in the background all these currents that are happening, and you have multiple victims. You have the original crime victim. You have the person that's wrongly convicted as a victim. You have the crime victim's family, who is multiple victims again, or the crime victim if they're still living, say in the case of a rape. And now they're wondering, did I identify the wrong guy in the lineup? Was it my fault he's been in prison for 15 years? Or no, he's really guilty. They're letting the guy that did this to me back out on the street. You know, there's all these conflicting things going on. So I did spend a lot of time reading about these various stories, and they're all different. It's kind of fascinating. But the Innocence Project has looked at the categories they fall in, and they do tend to fall in certain categories. The majority of the exonerees have been African American, for example. They have tend to be concentrated in certain states. Texas has had a lot of late. They've had five just in the last year. Interestingly enough, too, only, I think at last count, 20 or 30 states have now passed legislation to give remuneration to wrongly convicted prisoners. But there are a lot of states out there that don't have nothing. So if you're in I think Virginia's has that now or in the process of it, but in several states, if you were, you could be have been in prison for 10 years and get out now and nothing. I mean, of course, though, there are lawsuits and, you know, lawyers being what they will. But.
Another person asked, after writing three PI novels, how is a book like Record of Wrongs different?
It was different. It was different in the sense that I had all new characters, a whole different cast of characters, and I had to figure out what point of view to tell it from. So, and I ended up, you know, from multiple points of view. So that was a stretch for me. It was more work in that regard. It was more work research-wise. But at the same time, there were a lot of similarities. There was that same sort of sense of, if you've read A Witness Above and you have, I hope both of you enjoyed it, but anyway. No, we actually had a few more that read it than that. But anyway, that's the old author's joke for their old books. But in that book, you know, that there, at the same time, there's an old murder case there. There's an old shooting, actually, that's occurred, and there's old stuff that gets dredged up. And it's the same thing here. It's old crime. You know, we're now coming back 10 years after the fact. You know, people have moved on. People have, you know, memories are faded, and, you know, the evidence is long, the trail's long gone cold. And, you know, in the case of Record of Wrongs. So there were a lot of familiar elements there. A lot of the moving parts were the same. What's different is that I think having multiple points of view allows you a little bit more easily to build suspense, because as the reader, you're getting a more macro view of what's happening than the actual narrators have. Whereas in a first-person PI novel, which I actually love writing, and there's another Pavlicek book that's already been written, and I hope there are going to be a lot more. But you're limited to that one little telescope, which has its own charm, which I really like. But with the multiple points, you can actually, you know, I don't do that in this book, but it even gives you the ability to go into, say, the killer's point of view, which some authors do. I'm not quite that creepy. I haven't quite gotten to that point yet. But no, that's a very powerful method to ratchet up suspense. And you know, many best-selling books do that. They'll go into they'll give the killer's perspective on things, often very warped, very strange kind of viewpoint on things, and that just ratchets up the tension for the heroes or heroines or victims or whoever they might be.
So. An audience member asked, is DNA evidence more important for finding the guilty or the innocent?
Both. How's that for a political answer? Yeah. I think the two go hand in glove, really, in our system, because everybody's presumed innocent until proven guilty. So I think you can't have one without the other. And so, and probably any, you know, ethical prosecutor would say the same thing. So really, you know, it's a matter of if you do have cases out there, and there certainly are cases, obviously, that we don't know what the percentage are, that there are people wrongly, and that they need to be ferreted out, because that speaks to the credibility of the overall system. You know, just like, you know, most of you know, my wife's a physician, and you know, we all have a lot of faith in science these days, but medicine is still an art. It's still the medical arts, and there's a certain amount of give and take and so forth with it. Well, the criminal justice system is no different. DNA and everything aside, you know, I haven't even gotten into this, but there's a whole theory about the CSI effect that's going on now that affects juries. And, you know, people see all these crime shows on TV, and, you know, the person solves the crime, and you know, 28 minutes plus commercials, and they need to have a DNA test, and they call it up, and oh, it's on the microscope, and there it is. And you know, the real life, you know, people involved with it, the detectives from the, you know, to the crime techs and so forth, just cringe at that, because in real life, the resources for that kind of thing take months sometimes to happen. You order a DNA test, and you're lucky to get it back next year before the case goes to trial. So the real life system is very imperfect. There's a lot of give and take. You hope that you end up with finding the innocent as well, you know, the guilty as well as the innocent, and that you don't make mistakes. So I think DNA is a very powerful tool to help that, to help both. And I'm part of a group of authors founded by Jan Burke on the West Coast called the Crime Lab Project, and sort of her mission was to educate people about crime labs and DNA and funding. And there has been, DNA testing in general has been woefully underfunded here in the United States compared to other countries such as Great Britain. Virginia is a little bit of an exception to that. Virginia has been on the cutting edge and for a long time was one of the first states to get into that. And that's been good. But again, I think there's a lag between the technology and the funding and people who make policy decisions actually looking at all the implications of how to spend the money and so forth. And there's actually tension now. Do you take some of the money that's being used to upgrade lab equipment and make it more available to look at all these old cases? Well, I would argue that's probably not a bad idea. But again, you know, there's going to be people fighting over federal dollars and so forth for that. So you asked the right question. I mean, it's a very tough question.
Another person wondered if DNA alteration could help criminals get away with their crimes.
There's a guy, and I can't remember all the details, but this is the kind of thing that you're going to see happening. There's a guy in prison in Colorado who wanted to implicate, somebody was having a relationship with his ex-girlfriend or something, and he somehow got the guy's DNA and put it on something and had one of his buddies commit a crime and set the guy up for it. And fortunately, he was caught doing that, but that's the kind of thing that we're evolving to. So DNA can also be manipulated by criminals who are very sophisticated and cunning to say, oh, well, I'm going to... I'll pin it on this person, or I don't like that person. I want to get back at them for something, and I can plant this at the scene, or you know, there's any number of things that can happen. So, yeah, and that DNA alteration. I mean, I've read a little bit about that. I don't know. That's pretty kind of sci-fi, sort of cutting edge, but you know, you could envision that certainly happening. Thank you all for coming.
To find out more about upcoming events at the New Dominion Bookshop, visit their site at www.newdominionbookshop.com.